All right, good afternoon, members. I call this meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee to order. And seeing that we have a quorum present, do we have someone who's willing to move the previous meeting minutes?
So moved.
All right, thank you. Chair Igo moves the approval of the minutes for March 17th, 2026. Any discussion of those meeting minutes?
Can somebody like ask?
All right, going once, going twice, hearing none, those in favor say aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. One aye, thank you for moving that. The minutes are approved. All right, so the first bill up on the docket is going to be House File 4207. Chair Howard, would you move your bill?
Yes, Chair Kozlowski, I would move House File 4207.
All right, and Chair Howard is moving this bill and referring it to the Committee on Taxes. Chair Howard, would you like to describe your bill?
First, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Great, thank you. And having the A3 amendment, would you please describe your amendment?
This is largely a technical amendment that gets the bill in the shape I prefer.
Great, all right. Chair Howard moves the A3 amendment. Any discussion of this amendment? All in favor say aye. Oppose? Great. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Howard, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski. Members, House File 4207 is the agency policy bill. Members, you might remember last year Representative Ray Rauer carried the policy bill and did an amazing walkthrough of the bill herself, line by line. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to turn it over to Dan Kitzberger with MHFA to walk through the bill.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please begin your testimony whenever you're ready.
Yeah. Thank you, co-chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Kitzberger, and I'm the legislative director at Minnesota Housing. As co-chair Howard noted, this is our agency policy bill for this year. Just a few items, really sort of technical in nature, and I can just walk through and maybe describe them a little bit and some of the thought behind it. So if we look at the bill, the first portion that we wanted to address was on line 3.1, and this is actually repeat language from last year. And what this says is that if you are applying for the state housing tax credit and you have an award through the Greater Minnesota Workforce Housing Development Program, you can waive the income requirements under the state housing tax credit. Again, this is something that some of our partners in the community have been interested in, and we're looking to get it across the finish line this year. Section 2, this would be a new portion in our agency's chapter of statute. The agency is looking to hire or onboard a number of what we're referring to as lived experience consultants. So these are individuals who have dealt with housing challenges throughout the course of their life. So they may have experienced homelessness, housing instability, high mobility. Perhaps they've been recipients of some of our programming, you know, whether it be rental assistance or family homelessness prevention, or they've lived in a unit that we've helped finance. And so these individuals would be responsible for about 30 hours of work over the course of several months, and they would be helping us score and evaluate applications that come to us through our competitive programs. So both through our consolidated RFP and then through programs that have their own standalone RFPs. And so this process is just getting underway. We've just posted a position description, and we're looking for, hopefully a large response so that we can onboard several dozen individuals to help us throughout our programming over the course of the next several months. So again, this is the first time we're going through this process. We're modeling this after other state agencies and some of the work that they've done helping move communities that are ultimately the end users of the programming closer to the process for awarding and committing funds. If you go down to 3.27, this is one that was affected by the technical, actually, no, it wasn't. This is one where anytime it throughout the bill where it says as described in subdivision 4, this is just a clarification of the reference that we wanted to have both in the local affordable housing aid statute and then the statewide affordable housing aid, just clarifying that if there's program income generated or proceeds generated, that it needs to be used on a qualifying project as described in subdivision 4. The next section is starting on line 4.24. This is in the statewide affordable housing program, and tribal nations each get their own amount under the formula. And what we're saying here is that if they can't expend the funds on a qualifying project by the deadline, they could then put that money into some sort of account. And it would be similar, this is being done to as a reflection that cities are allowed to establish a local housing trust fund. And so tribes could do something similar because they can't do that under, you know, the way that the local housing trust fund statute is currently constructed. And then if we look at 5.13, that's also the SAHA statute. We're clarifying here that it's only tier one cities and counties that have to comply with this subdivision under reporting. So really in an acknowledgement of tribal sovereignty, both our program staff and legal counsel thought that we didn't need to hear reporting on tribal nations' previous expenditures before they started receiving statewide affordable housing aid. And then if you look at section 6, that was the repealer that was inserted back in, and I can just talk about that a little bit. That was the result of some of the work group on recommendations for the work group on expediting rental assistance. And as part of that, the agency was asked to do a projection of the statewide need for emergency rental assistance. Unfortunately, in that time, we've lost the primary data source that we were using. It was the U.S. Census Bureau's Community Pulse Survey. And one of the questions that they asked in that was of renter households that were, you know, we were able to break down by income eligibility. One of the questions they asked was, how many months are you behind on rent? And so that was really a key part of that report and the data that we used to create that projection. And so, you know, in agreement with Chair Howard or Co-Chair Howard and Igo and Chair Port in the Senate, we'd like to keep talking about that and see what we can come up with. And I think that's everything. And I can answer questions if there are any.
All right, great. Thank you so much for your testimony and for being here today. Next, we'll move to public testimony. Is there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Any member discussion on this bill? All right, we'll move to Co-Chair Igo.
Thank you, Chair Kozlowski. My one question is just on section 2, and it's like the payments and stuff. Ballpark, like what? How much are those payments, just for transparency?
Yeah, Chair, Co-Chair Igo, the stipend would be $1,000 per individual.
Chair Igo, any follow-up?
That's all I needed. Thank you for the riveting presentation on a policy bill.
Great, and I'll just say I really appreciate your work in bringing this bill forward, especially on the tribal sovereignty piece and making sure that we can maximize every last penny, just as we do for counties and others, to make sure we're being flexible, but then also putting folks who are closest to the problems closest to the solution. So, Chair Howard, I'll move to you for any last words on your bill.
Mr. Kitzberger did a great job, and I appreciate the chance to work together with the agency as the session develops on these policies. policy items, and look forward to moving it forward at the end of the day. Thank you so much.
All right. Chair Howard renews the motion that House File 4207 as amended be referred to the Committee on Taxes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oppose? The motion prevails and House File 4207 as amended is referred to the Committee on Taxes. And I will hand the chair back to Chair Howard.
We are going to next hear Representative Lee's bill, who I think is up in other committees as well. That is House File 3981. And while Representative Lee is getting ready, I will move that the bill be brought in front of the committee. The motion on this will be to lay it over. And I'll also move the DE1 that Representative Lee is bringing. Representative Lee, would you briefly describe your DE1?
Sure. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. So the DE1 just allows us to get the bill in the shape that we need because we had to get jackets really quickly. So,
any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE1 is adopted. Representative Lee, to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee for the opportunity to present before you today House File 3981 as amended. This is a common sense bill that would allow surviving family or other representatives of a deceased tenant to terminate a lease upon death. This is something that I found out in the course of helping a constituent that in the state of Minnesota, when you pass away, your family actually has to give notice to your landlord and pay two more months of rent until that lease can be terminated. And so as we've all heard, the rent is too darn high. And even in death, you can't escape this. And so this is a solution that, would have helped in my constituent's case. And I would also note that the bill also takes measures to also make sure that there's parity between this lease termination clause and also an infirmity clause that the legislature passed recently, just to ensure that that those are the same standards. And with that, I have a testifier from Homeline who can provide more details.
Thank you. Welcome Maya Grimm, housing attorney for Homeline, to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Maya Grimm, and I'm a housing attorney at Homeline. We are a statewide tenant advocacy organization. Thank you to the committee and Representative Lee as well for allowing me to testify in support of House File 3981. Passing this bill would amend two different statutes which allow tenants to end their lease early in particularly difficult situations. The first is where a tenant has passed away or where a tenant needs to move into a medical care facility, which is also known as the infirmity statute. Both the death and infirmity statutes allow tenants to end their lease early with currently 2 months' notice, and this bill proposes to reduce the amount of notice that is required. These two statutes were designed to provide relief for tenants who are experiencing these life changes that tenants typically do not and really cannot plan for. By decreasing the amount of notice that the tenant or their personal representative has to give to end the lease, tenants will be able to limit more of the rent that they owe so they can focus on using that money to pay for other expenses that inevitably come up in these situations, like hiring an estate attorney when a tenant passes away or covering medical expenses. This bill will also make the break lease option available for more tenants who are affected by the death of a tenant. Originally, under both of these statutes, the lease could only be broken if all tenants on the lease passed away or became infirm, which really limited when this law could be used. But in 2024, the infirmity statute was amended so that a lease could be broken if just one tenant becomes infirm. This bill would amend the death statute to align with the infirmity statute so that the option to break the lease is there if just one tenant passes away. And this bill would also make it so that upon the death of a tenant, all surviving tenants have to agree to terminate the lease. This addresses kind of the unintended consequence of allowing just one tenant to end the lease so that any surviving tenants aren't blindsided with having their lease terminated early, especially because neither of the statutes require co-tenants to be notified that their lease is going to end early. And we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Lee to strengthen this bill further. We believe that this bill would allow for a more practical application of the law, since it's relatively rare for all tenants on a lease to pass away at the same time. It would protect any surviving tenants and allow tenants to save more money in these difficult situations. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Next on the list is Cecil Smith, President and CEO of Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Cecil Smith. I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, who provides housing for over 600,000 Minnesotans through our 300,000 rental homes. We appreciate the intent behind House File 3981. However, even with the delete all amendment, we remain concerned that the bill creates an imbalance in the statute and shortens important notice timelines. Under this bill, an authorized representative of a renter's estate could have a notice period as short as 2 or 3 weeks, depending on when the notice is provided. At the same time, the housing provider's obligations following the death of a resident remain unchanged and continue to operate with a 2 month notice effectively on the last day of the month. As a result, the statute would create an imbalance where the renter's estate or surviving residents can terminate a lease on a much shorter timeline, while the housing provider remains bound by longer notice periods. The amendment also maintains most of the existing infirmity framework, but shortens the period in which a housing provider can offer an accessible unit in the same complex from 2 months to 1 month. In practice, that change may actually make it harder to accommodate residents through an internal transfer or preserve housing stability. Rental housing providers rely on predictable timelines to manage vacancy, turnover costs, and building operations. When termination periods become shorter or asymmetric, it can create unexpected financial and operational challenges. This is especially true in senior housing and in higher care facilities. We respectfully ask the committee to maintain balanced notice periods. Thank you for your consideration.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? Not seeing anyone, we can move on to member discussion. Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard, for the bill author, and maybe for the testifier. Question would be with the language in there for retroactive, with the contract language, are there any issues that you foresee with this maybe causing future problems with retroactive contracts language?
Ms. Grimm?
This is not a retroactive, Chair. This would not be a retroactive amendment. It actually keeps the death statute originally how it's written for leases that are signed before July 1st, 2026, so that the current process would remain in place for those leases signed before that date. But for leases signed on or after July 1st, 2026, this new process would be put into place. So it isn't retroactive.
Thank you for clarifying.
No problem.
Questions? Co-Chair Igo.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Thank you for the bill today. Kind of heard from some testimony. I share some of the similar concerns on making sure we iron this out to make sure that we are keeping that kind of management in the workplaces in the housing sphere. Because what I do worry about is this at scale, is hard as it is to say, could really affect pricing for those living in our rental units around the state. And that unpredictability, we don't need more of that in housing right now. So I think there's legs for this to start working right now, but like I said, I'm happy we're laying it over today so we can keep looking at it, but those are my concerns right now. I think the trickle-down effects are what could be intimidating to this bill. So, but thank you for your work on it, and we'll be following it as it continues working on its process.
I'm curious, Representative Lee, if you had a response to your testimony or any other comments. And I'll make a few comments before, but just curious if you wanted to make any additional comments.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to respond to the comments of the co-chair. So this is actually not a new idea. New York recently passed legislation that has a much shorter timeline. And I also want to just comment on the process of working on this bill with Homeline, that actually in balancing the interests of surviving tenants and other roommates, some of those concerns are actually mitigated. And so I do want to stress that. I mean, I think there's a concern about the snowball effect of, or you know, whatever that means. But, you know, New York is doing it, and they have one of the most, you know, high turnover rental markets. And for them, it's really important to get these units back on the market because there is a shortage of housing. And so, you know, actually, the argument can be made that, right, like, if the argument is that we don't have enough housing, and you know, we need to build more units, or you know, we need more options to bring price down, like, this actually would, this bill would actually help to address that issue. So I do want to just like make that clear. And so New York has instituted this. Colorado has a somewhat similar law about fees and you know, things that your landlord can't charge when someone dies and has to terminate their lease early. So just want to make sure that folks in the committee understand that.
Well, I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. To me, it seems eminently reasonable. You know, these are really unforeseen circumstances, and 2 months to me is a lot of time. And so I appreciate you bringing the bill forward and your continued work on it. Any final comments before we lay it over?
Yeah, final comment is just, you know, the last time that this statute was updated was in 1981. And so, you know, in working on this, something that I learned, or something that I think people have been reading about, is increasingly, because rent is so high, more and more people are choosing to live as roommates. Even like older adults or seniors are choosing to live in groups of, you know, 4, 5, and 6. And so this bill would also just modernize our tenant law to recognize the fact that, you know, people now like don't just live in single family homes. Because of the economy, you know, we are having to live in group settings. And so just appreciate the committee's consideration as you think about, you know, how we write housing laws to really reflect what Minnesota and the rest of the country looks like right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And with that, we'll lay your bill over. Next bill up is going to be House File 3639, Representative Hussein's bill. Representative Hussein, would you like to move your bill to be in front of the committee?
Yes, Chair.
So moved. Your bill is in front of the committee, and the plan is to hear this bill and lay it over. Would you please describe your bill?
Thank you, Member of the Committee, Chair Hauer, Chair Igo. House File 3639 imagines being 18 years old and trying to rent your first, we started with 1839, right?
3639, that's correct, yep.
Yes, imagine it's being 18 years old and trying to rent your first apartment. You submit an application, paying fees, and getting denied because of poor rent history. But this is your first time renting. You later learn that you might want to list on eviction case as a minor when your parent lost their house or lost their rent apartment. Now that eviction is showing up on your record. You had no legal responsibility in this situation, no control over the outcome, and likely you unaware it was even happening. You don't even know it. Yet you are carrying these consequences into your adulthood. This bill addresses the gap in our law. It stabilizes the minor children cannot be listed as a tenant on resident list or named as a definite in eviction action. This bill, what it does is to protect our minors, to make sure that they don't get eviction, because we have seen and we have heard about a lot of people in my constituents affecting every Minnesotan, that when their mom and dad go to eviction, the minor also show up on the court. And that's why I have a testify who's going to explain in a little bit more in the bill.
We'll move to testifiers. First up is Michael Dahl, Public Policy Director with Homeline. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Howard and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3639. And thank you to Representative Hussein for championing this legislation. My name is Michael Dahl, and I serve as Public Policy Director at Homeline. We provide free legal, organizing, educational, and advocacy services to tenants across Minnesota. Since 1992, we've served over 357,000 renter households, including last year, which was had a record year. As Representative Hussein has noted, young adults should not have their rental or credit history harmed by the actions of their parents. But the consequences go beyond the record itself. There are also financial impacts. A young adult may pay multiple application fees while searching for a new apartment, costs that quickly add up. And when you later find out that an eviction is on your record, they may want to pursue an expungement to clear their rental history. This can cost something to about $300. For many young renters, this expense is upfront expense is significant, but it may be unaffordable, or it may drain the limited savings they rely on to cover rent, utilities, and other essential bills. I raise this point because I know the financial penalty is a point of discussion, but in these cases, the young adult has done nothing wrong. They should have a pathway to be made whole. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Next up, Cecil Smith, President and CEO of Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Thank you. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Chair Igo, to the author, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Again, my name is Cecil Smith. I am with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Let me begin by saying clearly our organization does not oppose the intent of this bill. Housing providers do not seek to file eviction actions against minors, and we agree that children should not be the subject of eviction proceedings. In the rare circumstance where minors appear on eviction filings, it's almost always because they were listed on the lease as members of the household, not because they were responsible for the lease obligations. However, we do have two concerns with the current language of the bill. First, paragraph A would prohibit minors from being listed as tenants on a lease. That provision directly conflicts with Minnesota Statute 504B216, subdivision 7B. Under the statute, landlords are required to list all tenants occupying the unit on the lease, and the statute does not distinguish between adults and minors. Housing providers with shared metered buildings are therefore required under existing law to list all occupants, including children, on the lease document. Second, we're concerned with the penalty structure of the paragraph C. The bill would allow treble damages for violations. Treble damages are typically reserved in statute for the most egregious conduct, intentional wrongdoing, or serious violations. In this situation, however, the issue is most often arises from a clerical or a procedural mistake. Imposing treble damages in that context would be disproportionate to the conduct involved. We believe the bill's core goal can be achieved while addressing our concerns. We've provided language to the bill author to that effect. We appreciate the author's work on this issue, and we hope we can reach agreement. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? If not, we can move to member discussion. First up, Representative Amania Hilsley.
Thank you, Chair Howard, Chair Igo, members, for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill. I'm actually shocked that we are hearing such a bill, to be honest. Children should never carry a burden of house instability in their records, right? Listing minors on a lease or eviction filing does not hold them accountable. It penalizes them for circumstances entirely out of their control. And so this bill is simple and, I truly believe, common sense bill in my perspective. step towards protecting kids from long-term harm while still ensuring that children's future is not defined by housing crisis that they did not create. So for me, let's do the right thing and protect our children and give them a fair start instead of penalizing them. Thank you so much.
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Just be very brief here. I signed on to the bill because I think it's a great bill. As a former teacher, I believe all kids deserve equal opportunities in life, and they shouldn't be denied those opportunities because of their parents' actions or held accountable for the actions of their parents. So I hope that we can make sure the details of the bill are worked out and get this bill moved forward. Thank you.
Vice Chair Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Howard and Representative Hussein for bringing this bill forward. This is actually a bill that in my first term, we heard testimony quite a bit around especially homeless youth talking about their stories of evictions being on their records and following them for what was nothing to do with their fault. And so to hear about the $300 fee, that's pretty insurmountable for our young people who I just want to call attention to the letter in our packets from the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, you know, talking about our young people already carrying so many burdens, having to be navigators, language interpreters, taking on jobs to keep their families afloat and food on the table. And so making sure that we're putting the responsibility where it belongs, and that's with the parents or guardians. I'll say that there are, I hear the concern around the treble damages and that conflicting because it is the 504B written. And so I'm not sure if that's something that we'll be addressing more holistically. Sounds like that's a conflict that needs to be worked out. But I do actually believe that there does need to be some enforcement mechanism. We're talking about children, our youngest, who are so often our most vulnerable and really preyed upon when they do fall into eviction. And so there's a whole host of work that this legislature, and I've been proud to be a part of leading some of that, to create that roadmap out of homelessness. And if this is one of those levers that's the on-ramp and leading our young people down a road that they should never have to have gone and start from a deficit, I think look forward to working together to make this right so that this wrong doesn't follow our young people into their future. So thank you.
Representative Dotsiff.
Thank you, Chair Howard. I wonder if we could pull the testifier, Sethel, if he could come back up again. Thank you. And just a brief comment. I think we understand that we definitely don't want to have minors pulled in on leases. But the question I would have is, Sethel, are there some mechanisms in place right now that you see where the judges are actually working on trying to make sure that those minor children are removed, and the intent of actually putting them on the leases for eviction to make sure that all residents are removed from the property so you don't, for legality reasons, I think is maybe more of the best reason why they name everyone on the lease. Is that correct?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dotsiff. So just to walk through the process, when there is a filing, you will certainly list the adults. You may say that there are minor children. You may list them as Jane and John Doe's. You wouldn't list them on the filing. When you file an eviction action, you have to file full legal name and date of birth. There's an opportunity for the clerk to reject the filing because you're filing against a minor. Cannot file, bring a civil action against a minor. The judge, when the case comes before the judge, can dismiss the case against any listed minor children, reviewing who are the defendants in the case. So there are those existing opportunities. For the minor who later becomes an adult, wants to correct the record, a motion filing fee is $70. And the judge can then waive that filing fee when the proceedings begin. So there is ample opportunity through the court proceedings, through the court processes. Certainly, it shouldn't happen in the first place. And presumably, it's an inadvertent error, and that can be corrected.
Anything further, Mr. Dotsiff?
No, thank you for the clarification. I'm certain that we can move forward eventually and get some language that's going to work for all parties involved here. So thank you.
Co-Chair Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hussein, thanks for the work. You and I have been talking a lot on this bill, trying to get to a place. I mean, we heard some good testimony on the things that got to get worked out. I just really want to emphasize it's my biggest thing was that paragraph A, because I just think I was so worried about there's a fire in a building and we don't know how many people are in that building, or there's a missing persons and now we don't know who those people are because we don't know where they live. Like, that can have lasting consequences and create bigger issues. And it sounds like we're working on fixing that paragraph A. So happy that we're laying it over today and continuing discussion, but I think we're hopefully going to be able to get somewhere, but there's some serious concerns and I think we're getting close to the resolution. So thank you for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hussein. I'm supportive. I think this is a really good bill. Just a quick comment that, you know, this may be rare, but the fact that it happens at all is a problem. It should never happen. And so I really view this bill as a way to get at this, the source. The problem starts if folks are listed on a filing. And so that's why the bill makes sense. I do think there are some of these issues like that were raised that we can and are working through. But to me, this makes sense and is a bill that has and should have the ability for us to get across the finish line this year. And so thank you for working on the bill. Representative Hussein, anything in further before we lay it over?
Thank you, Chair Hauer and Chair Igo. I am working on that language and we all agree to it. And hopefully we'll bring this back and see if we can pass as a bipartisan, because we should never have this in the first place. Thank you very much.
With that, House File 3639 is laid over. Thank you. Representative Hussein, you can stay up there. Next up is House File 3064, the St. Paul Public Housing Agency grant funding bill. Representative Hussein, would you like to move your bill in front of the committee? Oh. I looked up and you're gone, and luckily you're not too far away. I did hear you, Representative Hussein. You have moved your bill, and I'll mention the plan is to lay this bill over. You have the A1 amendment. Would you briefly describe your A1?
Can we have a bipartisan describe that? I don't have it.
Sure. Let's see here. Do we have a? Hold on. Let me see if I can grab it quick. I'm just looking at it. It looks like it does just get the appropriation lined up for the future year to make that change. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right, Representative Hussein, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. And House File 3064 is about preserving deeply affordable housing that already exists in our community. This is about one-time $20 million investment to stabilize home for families who on the everydays, at the time when housing costs rising, it cannot be afforded to lose. Approximately $20 million Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for granted to St. Paul Public Housing Agency. This fund will use rehabilitation, preserve, repair, and many other HVAC and moving. So I was able to tour with St. Paul Public Housing in this summer, and I have seen many properties that really needed some work need to be done. And within the federal cutting and all this deficit that we've seen, it's costing us a lot. And this is its majority BIPOC community, 93% of people of color, 83% of women led, 91 family with children. And this is the time that we can save many people. We don't want it to see more homelessness. And the housing is, once upon a time, I used to live in public housing as well in my young age, and my mom was not able to afford anything until I finished my college. This is the place that, you know, prevent me and to give me who I am, you know, was able to go to college, graduated, and then buy my own house. And many people, immigrants and many people, people of color, women, and people who have children that cannot afford for rent. So this is a model that we save lives. And I do have a testifier. I don't know who's going to go first.
Yes. On the list signed up, I have Luis Seba, Executive Director with St. Paul Public Housing Agency, and I think it's a team up here. So whoever wants to go first, just please introduce yourself in front of the committee.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Howard and Chair Igo, members of the committee, Representative Hussein. My name is Luis Seba, and I am the Executive Director of the St. Paul Public Housing Agency. With me today at the table is Lisa Fiedler. She is the Policy Director for the agency. We are here in support of House File 3064, which would grant St. Paul PHA funds it desperately needs to repair and preserve our public housing properties, to provide safe, quality, deeply affordable housing for current residents and for future generations. Our organization provides nearly 10,000 deeply affordable housing opportunities for over 22,000 individuals, making up about 7% of the population in the city of St. Paul. The program that we're talking about today is the Low Income Public Housing Program, with 418 deeply affordable homes scattered across our capital city. Now, you might wonder what I mean when I say deeply affordable, and I mean that residents of these units pay 30% of their income for rent. So they are affordable at any income level, and they remain affordable for households even if their income decreases. As Representative Hussein has stated, we are requesting a one-time $20 million investment from the Minnesota Legislature to address the capital needs backlog in these properties. This investment would address necessary critical repairs, maintenance projects, and help position the portfolio for future success. Now, as you can guess, these properties are not new. They range in age from 35 years to over 125 years old, with an average age of about 68 years. As a result of age and unfortunate historic underfunding from the federal government, the capital needs in these properties are significant. Our current capital needs estimate is about $44 million for this portfolio. The asset, these properties that we are looking to preserve, is publicly owned with an estimated market value of $100 million. Investing in this housing and ensuring that it is maintained as deeply affordable housing provides a public benefit to the city of St. Paul and to the state of Minnesota. These properties annually bring approximately $2.6 million federal dollars to Minnesota. The capital needs backlog in our public housing portfolio consists of vital components for unit preservation and for tenant safety. It includes necessary thinking about roofs, siding, window on the exterior, essential interior work, walls, cabinets, floors, required mechanical here in the state of Minnesota, HVAC, plumbing. That's what this money would go towards. And it should come as no surprise that preservation of affordable housing is far more affordable than building new affordable housing. Our request before you today averages out to about $48,000 per unit, while the cost to develop a comparable unit would be about $448,000. That means that building 418 scattered site homes throughout the city would cost an estimated $187 million. So in rough math, this means that the cost to replace these units would be over nine times what we are requesting to preserve them. And I'd like to emphasize preserving these units and assets is good financial stewardship of public funds. And of course, I would be remiss if I did not highlight who benefits from preserving this housing. Preserving these homes provides a foundational safety net for some of St. Paul's most vulnerable residents. As we've heard, 91% of these households include minor children, 83% of these households are headed by women, 77% of these households have income from employment, from the military, from a small business that they run, and 27% of these households are elderly or disabled. So these deeply affordable homes are a launching pad to self-sufficiency for families, many leaving these scattered site homes and buying a home of their own. So thank you, Representative Hussein, for championing the St. Paul Public Housing Agency's request for this capital investment from the state. Thank you to the committee for your time and consideration this afternoon. And we are able to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. We will move on to member discussion. Chair Igo.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Just want to ask about, so reading the bill language, I want to talk about the nonprofit that would be doing the work. Just explain to me how that works. So is it City of St. Paul runs and operates this nonprofit then?
Great question, Chair Igo. The nonprofit is a wholly owned subsidiary of the St. Paul Public Housing, and we're a separate entity from the City of St. Paul. And that is created because of an effort that we are doing to reposition the homes for better funding from the federal government. And I would turn it over to my policy director for some details on that.
Yes, Chair Igo. This request is one prong of a two-prong strategy to preserve these properties. The other thing that we're doing is asset repositioning, which would change the HUD funding stream. This requires us to transfer ownership to a wholly owned subsidiary nonprofit organization. But it does lead to that better ongoing funding, which, while not sufficient to address this backlog, is what makes us able to structure this as a absolute one-time ask.
Coach Rago?
Yeah, thank you for that answer. So the thing that I'm just curious about then, so if Capital City Affordable Housing would be doing the rehab, does that kind of then make sure, like, is there still like an RFP for contractors, vendors to go out there and do it? Or so they're just managing the money and then still putting out competitive bids so that we can get the lowest price possible to do the most good? See what I mean? Like, that's my question there.
Whoever wants to respond. Yep.
I'm happy to. Chair Igo, yeah, it is run the same way as St. Paul Public Housing. It is the same board. It is a wholly owned subsidiary. It is a way for us to move into a better funding stream. But, yes, there is an RFP. It is managed the same way that we manage our investments if we did not have that. And to be fair, to be sure, we are in that, like Policy Director Lisa Fiedler says, this is a two-prong approach. And so you notice that I'm not sitting here and asking for $44 million because we're working on the balance of that through this other avenue. But the Capital City Affordable Housing doesn't change that this is deeply affordable housing owned and operated by the city, by the public housing agency of the City of St. Paul. I hope that answers your question.
Coach Rago?
Just follow up. I was just wanting to make sure that, so like there's some nonprofits, right, that have all of the associates training the staff that do the work. I just didn't want to see an ask for money to go to one place that wasn't going to have competitive bids, that was going to figure out the price and do it themselves, because then that would impede our ability to get things done the most affordable way possible. So that's what I was trying to feel out. And it sounds like, no, this is just the managing firm. They still do the RFPs. They still do competitive grants. And we still find the most affordable way to do it, correct?
And yes. They work with the unions.
And yes, and thank you, Representative Hussein. Yes, it is still our employees. There's no new employees of Capital City Affordable Housing. It is contracted out with the St. Paul Public Housing Agency employees. And follows all of those same rules.
This is similar to what the kind of the RAD repositioning that other entities have done, where you basically, it's literally the same board. I think Duluth and Minneapolis has done that model. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes, Chair Howard.
Yeah.
Very similar. In fact, in our high rise and family developments, we've gone through that RAD transaction. When we did that in 2020, we could not include this in it because it did not pencil out. We had such a large capital backlog. Now we have another avenue under similar repositioning called Section 18, which would be project-based vouchers. But yes, you've hit the nail on the head. This is a repositioning strategy that we were able to do in some of our portfolio, but not this. And now we are looking to do it with the 418 scattered site homes. And that's why it's a one-time ask, because we will have better funding going forward. But right now we're in a real hole with this very important asset.
Thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. We absolutely, as you mentioned, are in such a hole with investment, with public housing across the state, in large part with the federal government just completely abdicating their responsibility over, you know, a generation or more at this point. And so I appreciate bringing forward this bill. It's very important. So Representative Hussein, any final words?
Yes, City of St. Paul, as you know, my city has more nonprofits, more government buildings, more charges, do not collect a lot, enough tax, and not like Minneapolis or other cities. This is the first time St. Paul Public Housing are asking for funding many, many years. I don't think so we have ever been to this committee and asked for funding. In this summer, I spent a lot of time with the director and with the St. Paul delegations, and we seen in our own eyes those buildings is going to collapse if we don't act up as quick as we can. This is about dignity and stability and making sure family can stay in their own community. The people that I've spoke with is a diverse community, and they love staying in their home, and they were urging us to not relocate, to make sure that we take care of our citizens. So please consider this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And with that, I will lay over 3064 as amended. And your third bill of the day, Representative Hussein, is House File 2123. Would you like to move your bill to be in front of the committee?
Yes, Chair, I would like to move.
The bill is in front of our committee, and the motion will be to lay this over. And Representative Hussein, I believe you have an A3 amendment. Could you briefly describe your A3? Representative Hussein.
It's an amendment that we try to reshape the bill to make sure that the landlord is opportunity to report the credit.
Any discussion to the A3? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A3 is adopted. Representative Hussein, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair. House File 2123 is more, it's a bill that, you know, will give people who rent in the state of Minnesota to give a credit. More than one third of Minnesotans rent their home and rent often their large monthly expenses. Yet rent to payment usually do not help renters build credit. As a result, many renters, especially young people, low-income families, and a minority community, remain credit infeasibility and lack of their financial opportunity. This, if we're talking about the poverty and we want to help our people in the state of Minnesota, this is a way that we can help them build a credit. Many people do not have a good credit. They cannot obtain a good insurance, they cannot obtain to buy a house, they cannot get a credit card, or they cannot buy a car affordable. You know, if we have a good credit, you're a good champion and you can accomplish a lot of things. And this is what we're trying to do. This bill, many other states has done it. California has done it. New York has done it. Colorado has done it, and Washington, D.C., the capital, has done it and give people opportunity to build their credit so they can, while they're renting, they can get some percentage of their credit to show. And I do have Samuel here who's going to testify on behalf of this bill.
Thanks. Our first testifier is Samuel Benda, Policy Entrepreneur Fellow with African American Leadership Forum. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Yeah, Chair and members of the committee, my name is Samuel Benda. I'm a policy fellow at the African American Leadership Forum. We are thinking do tank and in the Twin City, and we're committed to advancing Black-centered solutions and building a future for Minnesota and where opportunity and justice are actualized for all. We're here today because Minnesota renters face a basic financial injustice. Rent is the largest monthly expense for more than a million Minnesotans, but unlike mortgage payments, on-time rent payments does little to build a renter's wealth. Homeowners build equity every month. Renters build nothing. And this has created the credit invisible class in which low-income families and communities of colors are overrepresented. Without credit, people struggle to get a car, rent a home, secure insurance, or ever become homeowners. HF 2123 is our community-driven solution. After years of listening sessions with renters, housing providers, community groups, and impacted Minnesotans, we created a simple fix. Require large housing providers to offer an opt-in option for rent reporting. The impact is real. Credit bureau like TransUnion shows that rent reporting produces an average 60-point credit increase. For many Minnesotans and renters, this is the difference between being denied or approved for things that move a family forward. And let's be clear, this bill harms no one. It's voluntary for tenants. It exempts small landlords with 10 or fewer units. It asks the state for a modest investment that returns far more, as more Minnesotans will be able to participate in the financial system. This isn't just a bill, it's an equity bill. It rewards responsibility that Minnesotans already demonstrate every month. It opens real financial opportunity for people who have been locked out for far too long. I urge you all to support HF 2123. Thank you, and Chair and members, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Next, we have testifying virtually Kaylee Mundley, Community Lending Coordinator for Exodus Lending.
Hi, Kayla Mundley here from Exodus Lending. Good afternoon, Chair, members, and members of the committee. My name is Kayla Mundley. I serve as the Community Lending Coordinator for Exodus Lending. My work centers on helping people access a fair financial products, and I'm here today as both a professional and as a renter who is trying to build a life here in this community. Credit is not a luxury. It is a gateway to basic life necessities, housing, transportation, even sometimes employment. Some employers actually run credit checks now before completing an application. In today's economy, without credit, you cannot fully participate, and yet millions of renters, specifically in Minnesota, people who reliably pay on one of the largest expenses that they have, receive absolutely no credit for it. Homeowners build credit every single month by simply paying their mortgage. Why shouldn't renters earn the same benefit for paying their rent on time? Some will argue that credit cards offer an alternative path, but credit cards require credit to obtain, and they carry real risk and debt and penalty. Rent, on the other hand, is a payment people are already making. It is consistent, it is necessary, and it reflects financial responsibility. It deserves to count. Our credit system did not emerge from a neutral place. It is shaped by decades of racial and economic exclusion, redlining, discriminatory lending, and policies that blocked entire communities from building generational wealth. This bill is a modern step toward a system that recognizes financial contributions of all residents, not just from those who are already given a head start. I urge the community to support this bill. Let renters use what they're already doing to paying rent to build credit they need to move forward. It's practical, it is fair, and it's long overdue. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, and our last testifier, Cecil Smith. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Igo, members of the committee, the last time today you'll see me. Thank you for the opportunity again to testify. Again, my name is Cecil Smith. For the record, I represent the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. First, helping renters build credit through housing payments is a concept that some housing providers choose to do voluntarily. House File 2123 is not simply creating a new opportunity for renters. It imposes a new operational requirement on housing providers that may require vendors, software integration, staff training, and dispute resolution procedures. Second, the bill prohibits charging renters for participation while requiring housing providers to provide the service. While the bill appropriates grant funding to help offset costs, the total funding will not cover the implementation and administrative costs for many housing providers. Third, and most importantly, the bill focuses only on reporting on-time rent payments, on-time payments. That creates a fundamentally incomplete and potentially misleading reporting system. If the state requires reporting only positive payments while excluding late or missed payments, the result is no longer a neutral reporting system. It becomes a one-sided data point that does not reflect the true payment record. Finally, the bill raises compliance and liability concerns. Rent ledgers often include partial payments, subsidy timing payments, payment plans, or disputes. Without clear standards and safe harbor protections for good faith reporting errors, or a mandatory system could expose housing providers to unnecessary disputes and compliance risks. For these reasons, we respectfully ask that the committee to oppose House File 2123. Thank you.
Stay there for a sec. I had a couple questions. Mr. Smith, you mentioned administrative costs. Just help me understand what those are just to have a better understanding.
So reporting to credit agencies is not free. You've got to set up a portal. You've got to set up a process where the batch reporting can then go based upon the credit reporting agency's timing of payments. I'm not particularly familiar with this. You'd need to get the credit reporting agencies here in front of you, Mr. Chair.
So it would be I assume there is some level of reporting as it exists that some landlords utilize currently.
Mr. Chair,
yep.
So there are operators who provide this service as an amenity to their residents, or there are groups around the country who have come in and partnered on wealth building credit reporting programs to help renters, and they've formed a partnership together where they're doing that to elevate the financial life of the residents and their properties.
And just back to so you said sort of creating some sort of a portal. So that's a technical, like an IT cost. Is there a cost to the credit agency? Like do you have to pay the credit agency, or is it more just the setting up this sort of portal and having that sort of IT infrastructure?
So, Mr. Chair, there is IT infrastructure. There is training. I certainly know under federal fair credit reporting, just even the fact that we collect background checks and credit reporting, we have compliance just on that process alone using the background check companies, because we're actually handling credit data, so we already have an administrative cost built in and compliance cost built in just on doing background checks. To supply information to the credit reporting agencies, I believe requires fees. It requires IT requirements for secure handling of that information, and certainly training of staff to meet those requirements. But again, I would urge you to get expert testimony on the credit bureaus.
It would be interested to, if sort of the concern is the amount of expense for admin cost, would appreciate more specific information at some point about like what those are, just to help balance that out. But any folks on the list? Representative Kozlowski.
Thanks, Chair Howard, and our Representative Hussein for working on this bill. Credit invisibility, that's a word. I appreciate you sharing that. Growing up in a household that we didn't have no bank, credit cards or a problem, let alone buying a home. So I just wanted to thank you for the bill, you know, and credit scores, as was mentioned by one of our testifiers, redlining, all of it was tools that were created to box black and brown people out of our communities. And so I think it's appropriate and necessary to tackle the credit scores that were being left out of. I have a couple of questions, just kind of curious, like how this would actually work practically and how you're envisioning the grants and whatnot to roll out, kind of bouncing off of what Chair Howard was asking. If Cecil's gone, but maybe you could help answer the question or to our other testifiers of what you've seen in other cities, states that have done this. But do you have like a ballpark of what the cost is to subscribe, as you were saying, to the credit reporting system itself?
Maybe Mr. Benda?
Okay, yeah, I can answer that. What has been done in places like California is that they require landlords to offer the service, but then they charge roughly about $10 for that service, right? And what has come out of that is that you get some, low-income renters who cannot afford that, and so they've seen a lot of problems. So what we learned from that, which is quite new, right, and they're still figuring it out. There's a lot of data that's going to be coming out pretty soon. But what we learned from that is that, okay, we, in order to bring more folks in, we got to take away that financial burden. And that's why I engage with housing providers, and we talked about, okay, let's put that grant as a mechanism to try to offset those costs.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Howard, and I appreciate you kind of describing this on how it's played out in California. I know I would love to see any examples of where this is done and how we could implement that here in Minnesota. Also curious, in the bill language, it talks about that a renter can opt in and out at any time, and I'm assuming that would be online, or does that need to be in writing? And then also I'll just say, so yeah, just sort of how does that opt-in, opt-out process work? And then the second question is around the missed payment. So it says that you'll report a positive payment. But so say I'm a renting in an apartment. I do my payment for 3 consecutive months in a row, and then I opt out. Does that then get reported and then look like, oh, I've stopped paying my bill? That could have an unintended consequence, or does that ultimately go to boost towards my credit score because I've showed I can pay my rent for multiple months?
Yeah.
Mr. Benda.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, as you know, the system we have already punishes renters for not paying on time. Could lead to eviction. Also, late fees, those are punishment, right? So we have that mechanism. And what we're missing is that positive aspect of it. And I think it balances out if we, with this bill, because we truly believe that we have to build a system that rewards hardworking families. So that's one aspect of it. That's why. Your second question, what was the first question again?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I was just asking about the repeated making sure that if you opt in and you show a duration of you're paying your bills month in and month out, and then you opt out, that doesn't somehow inadvertently come back and have a negative impact.
So the idea of the bill is like when you move in, then the landlord would be like, well, this is an option available to you. You can choose to do it or not, right? So let's say you're in it and for some reason you want to get out of it, then you just have to inform your landlord, and then you'll be not to report, and then they will have to follow that.
Any further?
Thanks, Chair Howard, and for that. Now, I'll just say I think this is a really important step to look forward and take into in Minnesota, and I hope that we can continue to work through some of the practical pieces of how it would roll out and make sure that as many Minnesotans as possible can take advantage. I mean, I think we all saw that the governor's budget had some dollars towards more down payment assistance. I'm excited to see the letter of support from the Groundbreak Coalition that talks about bringing online 11,000 new homeowners and putting, you know, those 50,000 down payments and post payments in place. And so just anything that we can do to for folks who do want to create a nest egg, to build up their credit score and ultimately move into a home and build that generational wealth, this could be a really important tool to do that. So thank you for your work.
And I would
like to. The other thing that I would like to echo and try to add it in, a lot of people don't believe in having a credit card or, you know, like going into interest. This is given opportunity to build their credit if they want to buy a financial fee-based Islamic mortgage. This is how they can build to avoid for their religion prohibited, like not getting credit cards or not getting any interest. This is opportunity that they could build their credit.
And I had an additional question, and this might be for Mr. Bender or for our nonpartisan staff. Mm-hmm. As I read the legislation, you know, a landlord, you know, must offer this option of having their on-time rent payments reported. But as I read this, there's nothing that would preclude a landlord from reporting late payments or missed payments in this bill. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so that portion of the language is to, because we already have a system that they do it anyway. Like if you don't pay your rent, you get late fees and you could be evicted. So this, again, is meant to create a balance, to say you have to also report the.
But there's nothing in the language that says a landlord couldn't report missed rent, to a credit agency. Do I have that right?
I believe so.
Okay. Representative Dotseth.
Chair Howard, I think you actually kind of covered a little bit about what I was going to ask about reporting of negative rent as well. But question I had is traditionally rental payments, has that typically been put on the credit reports? I haven't seen that a whole lot in the past. Is that a new trend that we're looking at creating where reporting all rental history and that's part of the credit reports? Or am I missing something here?
Mr. Benda?
Could you repeat the question again?
Yeah, Representative Dotseth.
Traditionally, rental history hasn't been on a credit report.
Yeah.
Is this a new trend that we're trying to enforce and create as a new process as far as for credit reporting or
whatever? Yes. This is a very new policy area. What they realize is that, folks are paying a lot of their rent and not getting anything out of it, and that's a really good way for bringing folks who have been locked out of the financial system into the financial system. And you actually have private companies who are using this now as a way to offer more, give credit to, credit card to renters as well. So you have companies who are saying, okay, you report your credit to us, and then we could just report it to the credit bureau, and we'll give you some credit card.
Representative Dotseth?
Thank you for your clarification, and I'll kind of piggyback on what Chair Howard had mentioned, is making sure that if we're reporting the good history, we also want to make certain that the negative history is reported as well, because we do not want to look like we're manipulating credit reports as well. Thank you for your clarification.
Yeah.
Co-Chair Ego.
Looks like we're all singing from the same sheet of music, because that was going to be my question as well. My big thing, and I'm no lawyer, and I don't play one on TV, but looking at it, if we don't put into law that it would say on time and late or missed, I could see credit agencies looking at that, calling it fraudulent and not accrediting it. So I think the testifier, Mr. Smith, made a really good point that if this bill is going to move at all, we need to have credit agencies come to this committee and talk about it, because I was trying to review on my phone California's statute. California's statute does say on time along with late and missed in their statute. So I think that is going to be a critical part if this legislation is going to move anywhere, because I don't think credit agencies will be able to look at that and take it as duly noted and increase credit scores over it.
And can I,
Mr. Bender?
Three credit bureaus do have a mechanism in which you can report rent. They all have that, and so that is why this new policy area is really building enough grounds, because they're starting to see the benefits of this.
Coach Rago?
I'll just follow up. I'm not saying that credit agencies won't acknowledge it, but if the law says only good can be reported, mm-hmm. credit agencies won't take that. You need to have the good and bad. Like, it applies for your credit cards, applies for your mortgage payments. You need to be penalized on good and bad behavior. If we create a market where we're only given the good, but not when you make bad decisions, then that shouldn't increase your credit score. And I don't think the three major credit reporting agencies will take that into mind and acknowledge what we're trying to do here in this bill.
Well,
Mr. Bender.
Yeah, we do already, we're in the system, punish renters who don't pay on time through late fees as well as evictions, that it does go to the credit. I could tell you this personally. When I was at the University of Minnesota as an undergrad, I paid my rent on time, living at the University Commons. When I was moving out, there was some cleaning. I think when I moved in, there was a wheelchair in the closet. So I thought, well, it's their stuff. When I moved out, they billed me for that for $400. On principle ground, I refused to pay it. And I have the money, but I'm not paying it on principles. And so they were like, all right, cool. And then they sent it to the credit bureaus. It affected my credit score. It does. So that's one way right there. And there's millions of people in this state who are going through that. So we already have a mechanism in place for that.
Coach Rago.
Thank you. And so, like, respectfully, I understand your point, but they're two separate issues. What I'm trying to do is make sure that we're keeping legal precedent when we're talking about credit issues. If you create law that you only report good and not bad, credit agencies won't acknowledge that. You need to be rewarded for your good and bad behavior. Right. If I don't pay my mortgage,
right.
If I'm late on my mortgage, I get a ding on my credit score for that. But the law as it reads in the proposed bill, there is no reporting mechanism to ding me for being late on my rent. That's what I'm saying. I'm worried that you won't get an accredited program out of the way the bill sits right now.
I would say I think there is a mechanism, because it's not saying that folks can't, but maybe there's a way to continue working on it. But what I would say to the overall, what an important issue for us to be working on, especially if we're aiming, as I think we should be, to be reducing some of our gaps in terms of home ownership opportunities, and knowing that the ability for folks to have a credit score that allows you to make that next step into home ownership. We've talked so much in this committee about that being a goal, to create pathways into home ownership. And I think you've, Representative Hussein, Mr. Benda, you really identified a gap, or really an opportunity, so that for folks that are renters that are paying their rent on time, doing their work to create a path for that to be credited, for them to get more credit and have that path forward to home ownership. I think it's a really important and well thought out idea that merits this committee's attention and focus. And so thank you for bringing the bill forward. I wonder if you have any final words.
Thank you. It looks like we just keep echoes. When people behind their rent, in 5 days, they got late fees. After 5 days, 14 days, they all got an eviction letter, right? Some of the, like Minneapolis or other cities, within 14 days. If you don't pay it again, then you get eviction, and that's going to go automatically on your credit. So what we're saying is, let's give opportunity for those that are paying timely, monthly, every month, for those optional. We're not asking everyone to do so. we're giving those people that want to benefit from this program, that want to move out of from affordable housing or move out of Section 8, and they want to build their credit to buy their American dream. We're helping those people that really need it. Not a lot of people might not benefit from this program, but the people that really need it. This is a fairness opportunity and financial dignity, and I think this bill is simple, allows for responsibility to help and build their financial wealth future. Thank you, and I'm open to work with anyone to get this opportunity for those people voiceless that need opportunity to buy for the American dream house. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Hussein. With that, your bill is laid over. Remember, that's the last bill on our agenda, and with that, we are adjourned.